This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, will be back next week. Coming up, the ties that bind capitalism and slavery. New York's next supposedly progressive mayor picks a stop-and-frisk police commissioner. And Obama claims he's fighting economic inequality, despite all the evidence to the contrary. But first, while heads of state and notables from around the world travel to South Africa to honor Nelson Mandela, the grassroots activists of the People's Organization for Progress marked Mandela's legacy in downtown Newark, New Jersey. POP Chairman Larry Hamm explains.
We marched for Nelson Mandela because we wanted to highlight the revolutionary dimension of his personality. We felt that the media and the official positions that were taking on Mandela really gave us an anemic and eviscerated Mandela. At certain points, to listen to people describe the life of Nelson Mandela, you would have thought that he was a civil rights protester. Not that there's any dishonor in that, but it certainly is not an accurate depiction of who he was and the nature of the struggle in South Africa. Although the struggle in South Africa and the struggle of African Americans in this country are similar, they at the same time are very different. And you would hear the names Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King and Gandhi all in the same breath. And they are certainly men that could be mentioned in the same breath in the sense that they were great contributors to the struggle for human liberation. But they faced very different circumstances. When Nelson Mandela was arrested before he was put on trial and given his life imprisonment sentence, he was the leader of the armed wing of the African National Congress. He was a co-founder of Umkhonto weSizwe, the Spear of the Nation, which was the armed wing of the African National Congress. And, you know, everybody was speaking about Mandela at his funeral. Nobody mentioned the fact that for several decades, the ANC, as well as others in South Africa, waged armed struggle after having engaged in actions and campaigns of a nonviolent nature. They tried to do it nonviolently, but the racist apartheid regime was so unrepentant and so recalcitrant and so determined to hold on to white privilege that it became clear that there was no other recourse for the African population except to pick up arms. And yes, of course, after Mandela was elected, he did certainly call for reconciliation and call for peaceful change, but that was after having engaged in armed struggle. I mean, the fact of the matter is, Nelson Mandela was part of and a leader in an organization which for decades was a revolutionary organization, African National Congress. It was a banned organization. It was outlawed by the South African government. Nelson Mandela was a banned person. He wasn't just in prison for 27 years. You could not utter his name without being arrested. You could not print his name without being arrested, and you certainly could not print a picture of him without being arrested. He was a banned person. The South African government was trying to erase any evidence of his existence from the face of the earth. But because there was an African National Congress and other organizations in South Africa engaged in massive struggle of all kinds against the apartheid regime, that ultimately led to Mr. Mandela being freed. And it is an extraordinary story that a man who, in fact, was in prison, whose existence they tried to erase, later on became the president of the nation. In fact, the first democratically elected president of South Africa, not only the first black president, but the first democratically elected president. So when we marched and rallied on Sunday, we were trying to rescue that revolutionary dimension of Nelson Mandela's legacy. Because to eliminate that or omit that from any assessment of him is, in fact, to present a false picture, not only of him, but a false picture of the struggle of the masses of South Africa against the racist apartheid regime and carry them forward into the future.
And how do you think this bit of political education that you attempted to carry out on the streets of downtown Newark had an impact?
It definitely had an impact. We could see as we marched along, people who were standing on the sidewalk, they were throwing their fists up in the air, brother. And people who were riding by in their cars were blowing their horns. Some of them were throwing their fists out the window. But at the same time, there were people who had the look of bewilderment on their face. Because, believe it or not, and this is a great danger that we face, believe it or not, there are people who still don't know who Nelson Mandela is. There's a generation of young people who don't know who Malcolm X is. And there's a generation, the only reason they know a little bit about Dr. King is because there's a national holiday and schools are closed on that day, so they know a little bit about Martin Luther King. So, you know, it shows that we have work to do to keep the real legacies of these great revolutionaries, we have work to do to keep their legacies alive and to make sure that those legacies are passed down to generations coming after us. That's work that we have to do. But I was glad that we had the march. And it was a thing that the People's Organization for Progress had to do, because the People's Organization for Progress, one of its roots is in the anti-apartheid struggle. If you get the latest issue of the Montclair Times, the issue that came out yesterday, that's the paper of the city of Montclair, on the front page, they actually have a picture of just a button. And it is a button that one of the people who marched with us on Sunday had, and they have a picture of that button on the front page of their newspaper. And that button is a Free Nelson Mandela People's Organization for Progress button that was issued in 1983, the year that the People's Organization for Progress was founded. In fact, that is the first button that our organization ever issued. We issued that button before we even had our own organizational buttons printed, because the anti-apartheid struggle in the early 80s was still in full effect. Nelson Mandela was still in jail. The campaign for economic disengagement to get the U.S. to break its economic ties with South Africa was in full effect, in full swing. And that year, the year that POP was founded, we started a Free Nelson Mandela campaign. And we joined in with the campaign for economic disengagement. In fact, POP and certain POP members, including myself, were part of the struggle to get the state of New Jersey to divest its pension funds from companies and business that were giving key support to the racist South African regime. And so the struggle to liberate South Africa is part and parcel of the history of the People's Organization for Progress. So we had to march on Sunday, and we had to recognize the major contributions of Nelson Mandela.
That was Larry Hamm speaking from Newark, New Jersey. Peace and social justice activists converged on the U.S. Capitol last week in observation of International Human Rights Day. They demanded that the military budget be slashed dramatically to meet critical domestic needs. David Swanson, publisher of the influential website War is a Crime, was one of the speakers. President Obama wants to stay in Afghanistan for another 10 years. But Obama claims the U.S. will no longer be in a state of war in that country. We asked David Swanson, what kind of state will it be in Afghanistan if not war?
Well, it's not a war. It's an overseas contingency operation. But if it's contingent, what is it contingent on? How about the will of the American people while we slaughter other people in the name of democracy? We've been against being in Afghanistan for years now, poll after poll, by corporate media pollster after corporate media pollster, a majority saying, get them all out, bring them all home as soon as possible, for years. And we have this supposed budget crisis in Washington, D.C., while we're shelling out $10 million an hour for a war that the president's been given credit for ending for years while escalating it. Most people think is over and other people think is ending. But this new budget, the majority of which goes to the military, over 50%, 51.4% of the new budget goes to the military, which is down from the 57% Obama asked Congress for. There's $81 billion to continue the overseas contingency operation, not to be called a war, on the people of Afghanistan.
Well, the president is fighting tooth and nail for whatever he calls it, and he's fighting not so much with the U.S. Congress, which is not giving him much resistance, but with the president of Afghanistan.
Yeah, he can't control his puppet. He's got another defective puppet like everyone before him, like Maliki in Iraq, who didn't want, or at least whose government didn't want U.S. troops to remain, as Obama hoped, with immunity for prosecution for any crimes. Karzai is acting the same way. You know, Karzai is not a model global citizen. This is a corrupt politician, but someone who sees the writing on the wall, who doesn't want to be a martyr, who doesn't want to be the one who sold his nation out for decades to come, and who is saying quite reasonably, in fact, stop killing civilians, stop night raids, stop kicking in people's doors in the middle of the night and killing or kidnapping them. Commit to not sabotaging the election in April. Now, you know, maybe he wants to do that himself, but that's a reasonable demand. Commit to ending the practices that ought to be prosecuted in criminal courts. So simply asking that these practices end is a quite reasonable demand. And if the U.S. government is going to threaten to leave entirely, to cease its criminal operations in Afghanistan, we ought to be taking that more as a promise than a threat. And this could be quite a streak. You know, the missiles not going into Syria, the attack not forthcoming against Iran, in fact, negotiations underway, and the war on Afghanistan ending, despite the president's desire to continue it until 2024 and beyond. Continue it at a smaller scale, but continue it with the ever-present risk of escalation and with major bases on the border of Iran and the border of Pakistan that have led those countries to oppose any such deal, as well as Hamid Karzai's opposition.
The president says the U.S. combat role will be over in Afghanistan, but he'll have thousands of special forces and JSOC killer elite troops there. What do they do besides combat?
They do combat by another name, and they do provocation, and they do creation of hostility, and they do generation of enemies, and they do risk development, namely the risk of escalation and the bringing in of large numbers of additional troops. They do protection of corrupt government. They do maintenance of military sites, supposedly 9 major U.S. military bases to remain, and of weaponry. You know, one of the goals from the start has been to keep U.S. weaponry with the possibility of nuclear weapons and so-called missile defense weapons in Afghanistan. They do protection of other people's fossil fuels that somehow belong to U.S. corporations but have found their way under somebody else's ground. I mean, this is what they do. And to say it's not a war anymore, it's a different thing, you know, is absolutely dishonest. It's a war even if it's at a smaller scale. And at no matter what scale, it has the risk of developing into something larger. So, you know, this is a president who came into office with about 35,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, who tripled that to over 100,000 troops, and not just in 2010, but immediately upon coming into office in 2009. It's now down to under 50,000 troops, but more than when Obama first came into office. And he's been given credit for 4 or 5 years for ending the war in Afghanistan, while it's larger than when he came into office. This is insanity. And it's matched by the budget insanity of funding this thing for another $80 billion while everybody across the political spectrum in Washington, D.C., pretends that we're out of money. And we have to take food out of people's mouths. We can't have food stamps. We have to throw the sick to the mercies of the health insurance corporations. We have to take houses from over the heads of men, women, and children because we have no money. Well, none of those programs, none of them, costs $80 billion. And that's a little pinch out of the Pentagon spending. That's just this war, just for one more year. This is insanity as far as I can see.
The Democrats and Republicans have their budget compromise. It doesn't look anything like the kind of budget that was demanded by peace and social justice groups on Human Rights Day last week.
Yeah, we were in Washington, D.C. With many members of the Green Shadow Cabinet and representatives of all kinds of organizations, including the Progressive Democrats, and with people from North Philadelphia who told their stories, who told about not being able to feed their children even when they had the food stamps, which are now being cut back, putting their children to bed with water with sugar in it. I mean, this in the wealthiest nation on the planet, or at least in the top five by any ranking, but the greatest pile of money on the planet in this country and our own people without food to eat, much less the poor people of Afghanistan in possibly the poorest nation on the planet, been that way for years, not getting better under U.S.-NATO occupation. Now with the Taliban and the warlords and the foreign Western occupiers to deal with, three enemies for these people, most of whom not only had nothing to do with 9/11, but have never heard of it. Not to this day have they heard of it. Their interactions with Americans consist of the drones and the planes and the troops and the people kicking in their doors. This is incredibly destructive. And while we had a great number of Congress members off to South Africa to celebrate Nelson Mandela and the use of nonviolence to change a society and to undo injustice without blowback, and other Congress members staying home because there was a couple millimeters of snow, we were there on Capitol Hill to say, You cannot celebrate nonviolence and come back and dump over 50% of your money into so-called defense, the vast majority of which serves no defensive purpose, and no other nation on earth does it. It's offensive in every sense of the word.
David Swanson, publisher of the website War is a Crime. Bill de Blasio has been heralded as the most progressive politician to win the mayor's office in New York City in generations. De Blasio campaigned against stop and frisk, but when he takes office in January, he plans to appoint William Bratton as his police commissioner. Bratton was the top cop under Law and Order Mayor Rudy Giuliani in the mid-90s. We spoke with Carl Dix, a founder of Stop, Stop and Frisk, and asked, what was de Blasio's purpose in picking Bratton?
I think the purpose for this kind of appointment is to send a dual message. One message is to the actual people who run the show. I know what my role is, and I'm going to play it. That's what de Blasio was saying by reaching back and picking up a Giuliani retread, a man who ran the NYPD based on the broken windows theory, which is that you should target the areas and sections of society whose response to the conditions they face most threaten you with desaturation policing, flooding the ghettos and barrios with police who are unleashed to enforce even minor violations and non-existent violations, we should add. You know, because under Bratton, people got arrested for drinking a beer on their steps, on their porch, in their backyard. That's how far they took it. Folks who were violating no laws were routinely arrested, beaten down, and taken in. And stop and frisk, quiet as it was kept, was a key part of Bratton's strategy, only he had his specialized units, what were called street crimes units, carrying it out. Later, under Bloomberg and Kelly, they expanded it to the entire NYPD carrying it out. So what de Blasio is saying is, I will keep the lid on those sections of society, meaning Black and Latino people, especially the youth, that they are afraid might stand up and want to resist the miserable conditions that are being enforced on them. And at the same time, to the people who thought de Blasio represented something different, they are delivering a message. Yes, I campaigned on change. I told you that I was going to bring in a new day. I talked about this tale of two cities. Well, guess what? There will still be two cities. And the city that I represent, the city of the power brokers, the city of the elites, of the capitalist class, will continue to clamp down on the rest of you if you get out of line. And then I think a message that has to spread among people who were dissatisfied with the kind of Bloomberg-Kelly regime that was enforced in New York City, which is not only the police state clampdown, but also the rise of homelessness, because New York City now has more homeless children than at any other point in its history, even though Bloomberg styled himself as a philanthropist who cared about the poor. He presided over a rise in homeless children. And if you don't like that kind of city, cast away illusions, prepare for struggle. Cast away the illusions that a progressive, reform-minded mayor, or even a Black president for that matter, is the way to deal with the problems that Black people, Latino people, poor people, oppressed people have in this society, and prepare to struggle over those problems. Prepare to stand up and say no more to police brutality and police murder, to say no more to the way that they railroad people into prison for nothing. I mean, there was a story that recently came out about a young man who was held in Rikers for 3 years who had done nothing, and who the evidence that he had done nothing was right out there in front for everybody to see, but still they held him in jail for 3 years trying to get him to cop a plea. 3 years stolen from this young man's life. He was 16 when he was arrested because he refused to say that he had committed a crime that he hadn't. So that's to me is the various messages, the two messages from de Blasio, but then the one message that needs to come from the grassroots. Cast away illusions, prepare for struggle. Stop falling for these lines that there will be a savior coming down who's going to take care of business for you, and get busy uniting, standing up, and taking care of business for yourself.
What about the idea that de Blasio is actually worried that the cops could give him a very hard time? They've been known in New York City to act as an organized mob, and that he gave them Bratton rather than giving them someone from the outside in order to calm them down and not cause problems early in his term.
Well, look, I actually don't buy this thing that the cops act as an unruly mob in opposition to what the authorities need them to do. I don't buy that because it began to be raised in the Giuliani period, but what people leave out and conveniently forget about the Giuliani period is while there was a whole lot of racism in the police force, the unleashing of the police actually began under David Dinkins, even though Giuliani gets the credit. He increased the size of the police department. Police murders actually rose under the Dinkins period, and it was police murders of Black and Latino youth, many of them demonstratively. In fact, over half of them demonstratively were doing nothing wrong when this happened, but no police were ever punished for it because, to my way of thinking, if your police start getting out of control, bring the hammer down on them. And that's something that has never been done, even when there's been talk about police getting out of control, like the way they talked about the street crimes units were getting out of control in the aftermath of the murder of Amadou Diallo. But the reason they started saying that is because the exposure of what they were doing was bringing people to stand up and say, hey, this is unacceptable. this must stop, and people were taking to the streets to act to stop it. You know, and it's similar to the way that Mandela was released from prison when the apartheid situation got to the point where it could no longer keep the masses of black people under control, and they needed a way to do that. So I don't think that it is de Blasio feeling he has to offer this to the police. I think that basically de Blasio's thing about I'm going to take care of the way the police mess with you was what was needed to get him elected, and that he did not represent anything different on that front, just like he didn't represent anything different really on the front of income inequality, because while he was talking about his concern for the poor, he was being funded by the major real estate interest in New York City, and the first place he went after the election was to Wall Street to let them know, don't worry, I can take care of business for you. Look, people who want to engage with me over whether castaway illusions prepare for struggle is what's needed and whether we need to go into 2014 on the offensive against the police state clampdown that in New York City is called stop and frisk. Maybe it'll be called something else. It's called gang injunctions in California. But wherever they do it, whatever name they give it, it is unacceptable. It must be stopped, and we need to go into 2014 on the offensive against it. I'm going to be writing on this, and people can follow my writings at the website revcom.us, that's revcom.us, and they can follow the plans that the Stop Mass Incarceration Network is forging and will be stepping out on in January at the website stopmassincarceration.net. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, .net.
That was Carl Dix speaking from New York. The African People's Socialist Party held its 6th Congress in St. Petersburg, Florida last week. The party was founded in 1972. Chairman Omali Yeshitela presented the political report that will guide the party until its next Congress. He said capitalism and slavery are intertwined.
The capitalist state was born as an imperialist state from its inception. It was a state that was born through stealing lands from the indigenous people, from the attack on Africa, from the wars that was made against China, the Opium War, etc. It has always had this capacity to reach out and control the world. So the capitalist state is being extended into what we call neo-colonial countries today. That's the capitalist state. That's the imperialist state. And sometimes it's stronger or weaker depending on what the circumstances are in a particular place. So it is logical that the whole world is a threat. And the Haitian Revolution almost overturned the capitalist system. And think about this, because the whole world at that time, the economy of the world was organized around slavery. The whole economy of the world was organized around slavery. And you have this handful of incredible, magnificent African forces who rose up for the first successful slave revolt in history. The first successful workers' revolution in the world, right there, Haitian, African people, handful of people, you know, who made that struggle. And not only made that struggle, which was important and significant enough unto itself, but who, having made this struggle, declared that any slave on earth, you come to Haiti and you're free. Any slave on earth, that challenged the entire world capitalist system itself. I mean, Napoleon's best troops, led by his brother-in-law, came to Haiti and they wiped their asses out. So you have to have this horrible kind of organization that has as a special function to suppress those people who would try to take back their resources. Nobody's going to just sit down for this. That's why the drones are there. That's why aggression is being made against all the peoples around the world. And I appreciate everybody who's ever fought against this empire. And it's a natural instinct. And what is unnatural is the Sharptons and the Jacksons and all these other folk. It is unnatural. Marcus Garvey was a natural manifestation. Everybody wants to be free. This whole concept of being free with the so-called Emancipation Proclamation, the whole concept, first of all, is fallacious for a thousand different reasons. How can you have in captivity a whole group of people one day, right, and the next day say you are free, but you are now citizens of the United States? As phony as the citizenship was, right? How can I be free and then you tell me I'm a citizen of the oppressor's entity? If I'm free, it's up to me what the hell I'm going to be and where I'm going to be and the rest of that. You understand? You don't say you're free, now you're a citizen. And then act like they did me a favor. Please. Because we're talking about revolution. And I really want to put that, make sure that we are focused on this notion. That in order for us to be free, a recognition of the problem is not good enough. Being angry about what happened to us is not good enough. We are going to have to overturn this relationship. We're going to have to fight for power. This man, making the white man like us, being accepted by America, that stuff is not going to do it. What's going to have to happen is we're going to have to fight for power. There are all kinds of people right now in more, some kind of action or another in this country all the time. But the final question that we have to ask is toward what end? Is it enough just to be in motion? Is that all it takes? And we say it takes more than that. It takes revolution. It takes a struggle for power. We have to overturn this relationship we have with the oppressor, because this oppressor brings nothing but death and destruction. Imperialism, capitalism brings nothing but death and misery and destruction. It brings humiliation. And every conscious African person ought to be humiliated living under these conditions. Here we are, should recognize ourselves as a free people who refuse to live under this kind of submission. In order for that to happen, we have to have revolution. In order for revolution to happen, we have to have organization. And that organization has to be informed by advanced revolutionary theory. It must be about trying to overturn this relationship, because it ain't going to happen accidentally. And regardless of what Reverend Chicken Bone say, we are not going to be able to pray our way out of here. And it's not even complicated. All we got to do is look at what it took to put us in this situation. That's what it's going to take to get us out of this situation. And if you can find any place in history that we voted our way in here, then I say run to the polls. But it didn't happen that way, and we're not going to get out of here that way. So this discussion, you know, is talking about science. This political report is, we really struggle to try to bring a scientific understanding of the world, a scientific understanding of our place and destiny in this world. Sum it up, and let this be the foundation, the basis of how we create all kinds of policies and tactics and strategies in terms of winning our freedom. But the science of African internationalism helped our party avoid the ideological traps that serve to validate the assumptions of the superiority of white people and divert us from the mission of a united African people led by our working class, capturing power and uniting Africa and our nation. Our party brought science to our defeated African liberation movement at a time when it was generally bogged down in racial and cultural nationalism that indulged in candle-lit ceremonies, religious obscurantism, and a nostalgia for an often imaginary African past. We were able to discover the material basis for the exploitation, the material basis for the exploitation and oppression of Africans and others in this world. With African internationalism, we can understand the material forces at work in the movement of history. We can clearly see the current shift in the balance of power between the oppressed and the oppressor, between Europe and the rest of us, between the so-called white man and the so-called black man. We see this balance, this shift in the balance of forces happening right before our very eyes. We determined long ago that characterizing our movement as a struggle against racism was a self-defeating waste of time. What is called racism is simply the ideological foundation of capitalist imperialism. Rather than defining the system of our oppression, racism is a concept that denies Africans our national identity and dignity. It relegates us to the Sisyphean task of winning acceptance from and sometimes often becoming one with our oppressors. With African internationalism, we have proven that race is simply a colonial invention originating from the enslavement and colonization of Africans and Africa that gave birth to capitalism and simultaneously the European nation. Our struggle has always been one for power, not against racism, as we have shown. To the extent that we win power, the racism of others is irrelevant. Power is the great equalizer, the fundamental aphrodisiac that is capable of turning a racist of today into a fawning sycophant of tomorrow. The struggle against racism is a struggle of the petty bourgeoisie fighting to integrate into the white capitalist world, to board the sinking ship of white power. It is a diversionary struggle, reliant on failed philosophical assumptions that must be cast aside as a precondition for moving forward. This is not an innocent issue of semantics. The way this is understood informs our practice. The struggle against racism presupposes one approach, and the struggle against imperialist colonialism another. We are not a race, but a nation of people scattered across the globe. We have been pushed out of history by our imperialist oppressors, partially through the concept of race. Our national homeland has been occupied in various ways for millennia. Our people have been captured and forcibly dispersed around the world. Our labor and land have been violently extracted to build the European nation and world capitalist system that determine our reality and the contours of the struggle in which we have been engaged for more than 500 years. The fight against AFRICOM cannot be characterized as a struggle against racism any more than the liberation of our people in Haiti or the necessary unification of Africa to stop the rape of our motherland and the theft of its resources. The material conditions Africa suffer worldwide have their origin in the attack on Africa. That the material conditions that we suffer everywhere. Why is it that everywhere we look, Africans face the conditions that we do, whether it's in Stockholm, whether it's in Paris, whether it's in Berlin, whether it's in Ghana, or whether it's in the Bahamas or in the Fifth Ward of Houston, Texas? Our condition is the same, and it has its origin in the attack on Africa. It has been extended. The attack on Africa and our oppression, the theft of our homeland, our poverty, our misery, it's an extension of Africa that has been spread around the world.
Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the African People's Socialist Party. President Obama has lately been playing the role of populist politician. He recently called the growth of economic inequality the defining challenge of our time. Activist, author, and historian Paul Street has been following Obama's career since the 90s. Street says there is no substance to Obama's rhetoric, no program to help anybody but the rich. So what is Obama up to with all this populist speechifying?
Obama's up to what Bill Clinton was very good at and what Democrats have all tended to be pretty good at, which is what the once-upon-a-time leftist late political commentator Christopher Hitchens once accurately called the essence of American politics. The essence of American politics, Hitchens said, is the manipulation of populism by elitism. And so politicians who want to stay in power in our plutocracy learn how to and become expert at, and Obama's really quite practiced in this by now, double talk. And one set of things that are said in private or in relatively cloistered gatherings with the elite, which is a reassurance, don't worry. You know, I might have to sound kind of democratic and populist at certain times, but I'm here to serve your interests because you paid for my campaign, and you paid for my reelection and everything else. And a lot of us here in the White House are hoping we can get really good-paying jobs once our term is over, and so forth. And then the other conversation, which, you know, takes place in campus towns or when you're talking to a labor audience or you're talking in an inner-city neighborhood, you're trying to get people's votes. That discussion is completely different, and it's where you damn near sound like a socialist. You, at least you sound like a populist. You sound like a man or a woman of the people. We'll be hearing a lot of Hillary will be doing this in 2015 and 2016. A politician that's for a Joe Sixpack, for everyday working people, or you know, what is sort of always generically called the middle class, which seems to be about just everybody, except for the 1%. And, you know, you might even embrace, like Obama did in after the Occupy movement, you know, 99% values and identify yourself with, quote-unquote, the 99%. So that's what I think we're talking about here with Obama, and specifically I assume you're referring to this speech he gave and got so much credit for from Paul Krugman, you know, the New York Times liberal columnist, last week to the Center for American Progress.
What's fantastic about Obama, and you allude to it, is that he pretends as if he hasn't been president over the last 5 years when these vast inequalities have become, in fact, even more extreme.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just a remarkable speech 5 years into this guy's, dollar-soaked corporatist presidency, and it's kind of like sociopaths in general. You know, they have this way of posing as innocent, even sympathetic bystanders, you know, to the havoc that they created or helped create. You know, it's got nothing to do with me. You know, what's it got to do with me? So he gets up there in front of this Democratic Party-affiliated organization called the Center for American Progress, denounces the amount of wealth that the 10% has, he denounces the amount of income that the top 1% has, and says that income inequality is the defining issue of our time. It's not the first time he said that. He said it in Osawatomie in December of 2011 in the wake of the Occupy Rebellion. He said it in Galesburg, Illinois last summer and a few other locations in the Midwest. You know, and he said his administration is going to focus all of its efforts on fighting inequality. He even, and this is what excited Krugman so much, he even said that the deficit of opportunity in the country right now is a much bigger problem than the fiscal deficit, you know, than the federal deficit, than the budget deficit that our political culture has been obsessed with for years and years and years. So he says all this stuff as if he hadn't bailed out the financial overlord in 2009 and 2008 on record-setting levels. If he hadn't winked and nodded and shook hands with Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein and Goldman Sachs and agreed not to do anything to nationalize or cut down on financial institutions, as if he didn't marginalize single-payer real health insurance reform advocates completely from the health reform process and proceed to advance corporatist health care reform bill that just, you know, that might as well have been titled, you know, All Power to the Great Six Insurance Companies. You know, as if he didn't deep six. He had nice things to say in his speech about unions, you know, and as if he didn't deep six immediately from the beginning of his presidency, his campaign promise to advance the Employee Free Choice Act, which essentially would have re-legalized union organizing in this country, as if he hasn't been attacking Social Security and Medicare, as if he hasn't pushed deficit reduction in some ways even more dramatically than the Republicans have. And you could just sort of go on, as if he isn't right now pushing for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a secret so-called free trade deal, which will basically, you know, limit worker rights and limit environmental rights before. It's just like it's got nothing to do with me. It's just bizarre. It's, you know, it's psychologically disturbing. It would be better to just have open, explicitly, it would be more psychologically honest and less psychologically abusive, to just have openly corporatist, openly pro-business Republicans in the White House, right? Like George W. Bush, who, you know, said that the top 0.1%, he referred to them half-jokingly as his base. And that's my base. That's who I serve. It would be less psychologically abusive to just not pretend to care about democracy and social justice and equality and the pursuit of their business agenda than it is to wrap your corporatism in all this deceptive, fake, progressive clothing. You know, it reminds me, in the histories of the civil rights movement, after Dr. King and Abernathy and the Southern Christian Leadership Council had, you know, gone north and really sort of been pretty badly defeated in a so-called liberal north, particularly by Chicago's Mayor Daley. And returning to the South, Dr. King let slip at one point this comment. It was almost a relief to be back in the South, where, you know, it was just open. And the racism, the oppression, and the police statism was open and explicit and at least honest, right? The problem, you know, the North was they were screwing you over and doing nothing to alleviate poverty while they're pretending otherwise, pretending to love you. So, you know, it's at a certain point, and it's just kind of sickening. Of course, this has been going on for years with Obama.
Yes, Obama, for example, on his own initiative, froze the pay of federal workers 2 times.
Sure.
And on his initiative, on the Justice Department's initiative, they intervened in order to defend
in
the
Detroit.
Bankrupting of Detroit, which meant putting the retirees in Detroit's pensions into the toilet.
And without even it being required, you know, voluntarily, they intervened in the court process on behalf, essentially, of Wall Street setting this really dark precedent for what promises to be the devastation of public worker pensions across this country. Yeah, that's this guy. That's the same president who's getting up there trying to tell the Center for American Progress that inequality is the defining issue of our time and that we need to defend the public sector.
This is the president who gave a major jobs speech. It didn't have any jobs in it, but he said it was about jobs at an Amazon warehouse in Right to Work, Tennessee.
Oh, sure, yeah, where people are probably working for less than $10 an hour. I mean, you can go on. Now, this is a guy who wouldn't go anywhere near or provide any real support for the historic uprising, labor uprising, in defense of public sector workers' collective bargaining rights in 2011. He's refused federal assistance to states and municipalities that are facing budget crisis, which is leading to hundreds of thousands of people working, losing their job. And you sort of just go down the list of it. And the other thing is, Krugman was so excited just because he mouthed the words, you know, that the deficit of opportunity, because he claimed to believe Obama did this a bigger issue than the federal deficit. But if you actually look at the speech, and I always do this with Obama, and I've been through every word of the speech, there's incredibly little in the way of anything substantive that he had to say at all to put any meat on the bones of his rhetoric. I mean, you know, the minimum wage increase that he's talking about will still leave millions. What real low-wage workers are talking right now is a fight for $15 to $50 an hour. He's talking about coming up to, $9.25 or maybe even $10, which is still going to leave, you know, millions of workers well below the poverty threshold. I mean, he doesn't have anything to say about a financial transaction tax to fund food stamps programs or schooling programs or Medicare. He's not saying anything about renegotiating these trade bills so that they have labor rights. He's not talking about real progressive taxation. He's not talking about anything to really rein in the banks or to break them up or anything, really, anything at all. No call for major public works programs, or, you know, which to put millions of people who are structurally unemployed out of work and saving livable ecology and green jobs. You know, the Van Jones thing. He's not anything to say about any of that.
And as you point out, this is the president who coordinated the effort with mayors of cities to put down the Occupy movement.
Well, you know, that's the thing. Krugman called his column, Obama Gets Real, right? And if you look back in October 2011, there was this remarkable populist uprising across this country. I mean, it just started in Zuccotti Park. And there, but like you said in Black Agenda Report, it was like a cell phone map bursting out across the country. I mean, immediately, hundreds of these things focused laser-like on precisely the issue that Krugman is so excited that Obama rhetorically got behind, economic inequality. Krugman at the time praised the movement. He said, finally, we have a, you know, he's contrasting with the Tea Party. He said, finally, we have a real social movement that's angry at the right people, by which Krugman meant the financial overlords, the Wall Street barons, the robber barons, and so forth. And, you know, so what did Obama do? He sort of, for a brief period of time, politely permitted the rhetoric to continue while appropriating it, and then his people behind the scenes worked and coordinated from coast to coast to help execute a 21st century police state high-tech repression of these things. They shut them down in very graphic kinds of ways, with media blackouts and helicopters overhead and Nazi-like stormtroopers and all this kind of business. And by the way, you know, city governments are pretty much in this country run by the Democratic Party. It was a Democratic Party operation, the crushing of a real, of an actual movement against inequality. At the same time, they're appropriating some of the rhetoric of Occupy for use, you know, in what they consider to be the only relevant politics at all, which is the quadrennial, you know, big money, big media, candidate-centered electoral extravaganza. So they stole the rhetoric as they crushed the thing. It's just, it's so vile. It's just sort of unreal.
And so there is no substance behind President Obama's populist rhetoric, but there's a great deal of substance behind his pro-corporate policies.
Well, one of the really you know, nice lines in that speech, and this is a thing that progressives, I just, people with PhDs in campus town, they used to argue with people back when they were all getting crazy about Obama in 07 and 08, would you please read the small print? You know, you're clamping about all this populist-sounding stuff or this environmentalist-sounding stuff. Read the whole speech. One thing Obama said in this thing, very briefly, but it's very important, is, you know, when he started talking about solutions, he said, we got to simplify our tax code, right? Well, what does that mean? Everybody knows that's about cutting corporate taxes. He keeps talking about we have the highest corporate tax burden in the industrialized world, which is absolutely false. But he's continuing with this, you know, smash business taxes. He called for a, quote, a trade agenda that grows exports. And he said we have to relentlessly push a growth agenda. And so you can't talk about reducing inequality without talking about increasing the size of the pie. Well, that's standard neoliberal Western capitalist ideology for decades, right? We don't have to worry about how unequal we are really. The solution to inequality is growth. You know, we can grow our way out of it. You know, a rising sea lifts all boats, so no one really has to worry about, you know, the difference between people who are in these leaky rowboats and dinghies on one end and the people in the luxury yachts and the liners. On the other hand, you know, and among many problems about that, one of them now is that ideology is literally destroying livable ecology on this planet, this growth ideology. And Obama operatives right now, by the way, are going around trumpeting one of his great successes, our new energy independence from fracking, without even taking so much as a side glance at the deadly environmental consequences.
Paul Street is author of many books, including The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama, and The Real World of Power. Political prisoner Lynn Stewart, the people's lawyer serving a 10-year sentence for zealously defending her client, must also contend with stage 4 breast cancer this holiday season. We spoke with Stewart's husband and comrade, Ralph Pointer.
Yes, well, we're asking everyone to use their listserv and every means of communication to continue our campaign for home for the holidays for Lynn Stewart. Whatever message that people have, we're asking them to use their message to put pressure on the Bureau of Prisons, Obama and Holder, because Lynn has had a recent MRI, but the prison is slow in returning it, the results. So she's making formal requests because they haven't given her the result. Now, my speculation is that they want to say that she's getting better, and the MRI results prove that she is not. She is in a wheelchair, and she cannot comply with the rules of being back in the circulation out of the hospital because she cannot walk to get her meals, and she'll have to have somebody pick up her meals for her. She cannot stand in a pill line. And so they're setting up a situation where she will be violating or having other inmates violate regulations because they want to say that she's getting better. And so twice the warden has signed that she is not getting better. The first time the medical staff okayed it, but the second time they rewrote it so badly that you could not understand it. And then when they were asked to rewrite it, they delayed. And so now here we are, third go round. We're saying, bring Lynn home for the holidays, give her her MRI. And I'm in the North Country trying to provide space for her when she comes home to have a few moments of solitude before dying, watching the grass grow, watching the snow fly. And as Lynn, if you go to her website, you see that she has lost nothing mentally. Her article on Thanksgiving was very much to the point, and her article on receiving the Arthur Conoy Award from her alma mater, Rutgers University, and she's putting out another one on going up to Providence, Rhode Island, and she's putting out one for the St. Petersburg O'Malley Yashiteli's organization, and so she's writing prolifically. She writes to people as best she can, you know, answering every letter that's written to her, although it's difficult. So Lynn is keeping up her spirits, and we would just like to re-energize our efforts on a petition, having anyone who hasn't signed a petition to sign it, join those people around the country in supporting Lynn Stewart.
It sounds like the Obama administration is trying to run out the clock on Lynn Stewart.
That's exactly what they are doing. Stalling and stonewalling, I think, is the word. And the clock is running out on Lynn Stewart. They're lying about her condition, and they're giving her the Marilyn Buck, Herman Wallace treatment. And Obama is no different.
We know, of course, that Lynn Stewart has an extensive support group outside of prison, but you seem to be saying that inside prison she's got a supportive group as well.
That's a wonderful thing, knowing that the people inside the prison know who she have learned who she is. And many of the members of their family members outside the prison call me and email me and support Lynn because of what she has meant to the people inside the prison.
And how would people send Lynn Stewart holiday greetings or comradely greetings?
Either way, on the website, LynnStewart.org, we have three numbers that we have people calling. It says, make three calls for compassion. And President Obama, Attorney General Holder, Director of Prison Samuels, bring Lynn home for the holidays.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.